listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Ewan Lowe.
Happy Easter, Ewan.
Yes, happy Easter to you too. He is risen.
He is risen indeed. Mm. So, this is the second week of Easter, and we're going to be discussing today the Gospel reading, John 20, 19 to 31, Revelation 1, 4 to 8, and Acts 5, 27 to 32. And it's probably worth saying preachers have a huge richness of choices in this Easter season, because we're going to get a series of readings from Acts, so it's a chance to maybe do a bit of a series on Acts.
Yep. Likewise with Revelation.
Likewise with Revelation, which is a rare thing. It only happens every 3 years that we get this string of Revelation readings. And, of course, the John readings are rich with fodder too. Are there themes you've immediately seen as we've sort of prepared, you know, things that link these readings or make sense of why we have the readings we do?
Well, at first glance, they are a little disparate, aren't they? But,
yep.
But, you know, looking more closely at each one, I did notice the theme of the Spirit sort of appearing, right? In Revelation, obviously, it's a little bit different. You have the seven spirits instead of, you know, the one Holy Spirit, if you like. But certainly in the Johannine text and in Acts, there is mention of the Spirit in that Johannine text. Jesus is sort of breathing out his Spirit on people, which, you know, in 2022 we may not want to be doing in quite the same way. And yes. In the Acts passage, Peter, of course, appeals to the Spirit, really, as in his, you know, discussing his witness to Jesus and appeals to the Spirit as almost a co-witness in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, that's the other thing I think that is a bit of a theme, witnessing, particularly in the Acts readings today and going ahead. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, in some ways I've been really struck preparing for these Easter podcasts this year, how much of it is about responses to the resurrection. So our biblical authors don't try and explain or even overly theologize in a way, in a really explicit way, but we just get these insights into responses in terms of what does it mean for a Christian life.
I mean, there's almost that you don't find really the same sort of onus or burden of proof as you might find today, right? It's sort of like, well, here it is. It is what it is. Jesus is back. What are you going to do about it?
That's right. Yeah, they're asking different questions. They're asking the what does it mean for our lives question, not the how did it happen mechanics question.
Yeah, which is really interesting, right, because it's such a different mindset to what many would bring into this today.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get into the gospel. John 20, in a sense, we have in these last couple of chapters of John a series of resurrection appearances. And, of course, this is following last week's where it was Mary who really first sees the risen Jesus and testifies, I have seen the Lord.
Yes.
So she's our first witness.
That's right.
What did you notice? What do you want to highlight about today's reading?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the first thing that really jumped out, and it's something I hadn't noticed before, to be honest, but it was that contrast between Mary and Thomas, right? You know, as Jesus goes through his farewell tour, that's what it is, right, the last couple of chapters of John, you know, Mary is sort of there, she's seeing him, she believes, she comes back and tells everyone immediately. And I think there is a semi-deliberate contrast being made with Thomas, who is a bit more skeptical. And look, not without reason.
Yep.
You know, I don't think there's a problem with being a little bit skeptical. But, you know, the gospel writer, I think, is making a point here.
Yeah, and I think the very setting, like, so Mary was in a garden and that's where the tomb is in John, but now we're behind locked doors. We're in a house or some sort of upper room. It's evening. It's not the start of the day. So, I mean, we've got all of these contrasts that do that work you're pointing to. And we have this a very strong emotion of fear at the start of the reading, right? They're sort of, there's almost, I mean, the text doesn't use this word, but there's almost a sense that they're huddled and the fear of the Jewish leaders is named as still a legitimate thing. So whether that means they haven't quite believed Mary or the men are more scared than the women, I mean, we won't go into that. But yes, but it's almost like the impact of it hasn't quite hit them yet.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing that I find just as an interesting observation is that, you know, poor old Thomas, he's got a whole week
to wait.
To wait, right? And the others, you know, you've got to wonder if they started questioning themselves, right? You know, when one person is there going, oh, I don't know, I don't really believe what you saw, it's almost like gaslighting in a way.
Yeah.
Where, you know, after a week, maybe the others are likewise going, oh, did we really see Jesus? I don't know. And you mentioned before we started recording this whole thing of the evidence and seeing and touching. You want to unpack that a bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of things that I think are helpful to know. So sight and seeing is a really strong theme in John's gospel. Mm-hmm. So the Samaritan woman at the well, her testimony is to go to the town and say, mm-hmm. come and see. Mm-hmm. Even in the call stories back in, I think it's chapter one, maybe early chapter two, Nathaniel, you know, the call to discipleship is come and see this man. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense that the whole call to discipleship is framed as seeing. But also in the surrounding culture, you know, in the pagan religions of that world, you worship what you see. Mm-hmm. So you bow down or you offer sacrifices or incense or libations to a statue or a bust or a altar with images on it. Mm. So there is something about seeing and faith that I think is culturally really significant, which maybe like Orthodox and Catholic Christians would get a bit more than Protestants.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, almost certainly.
Yeah. So I think that's important. What else?
I guess that's why Paul in Colossians talks about, you know, the invisible God.
Yeah.
Right, to an extent. It is a bit weird when you think about it.
Yeah, and he's got to explain it almost in that we don't have this, physical bit of God I can point to and go, that's our God. Mm. That's what God looks like for us.
Yeah, and growing up in Southeast Asia, you know, most of the religious kind of practices there are very visual as well.
Yes.
Like you have an altar, like, you know, if people have been to, let's say, Bali, you know, they put out the offerings every day.
At a specific shrine kind of site.
That's right. Yep. So for a lot of human history, I suppose, religious worship is very sense-driven.
Yes. Yep. And so Christianity is, in a sense, weird.
Yes, a little bit ascetic.
And right. Judaism before that. But,
that's right, and then Islam after that.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, even more so perhaps. So there's, but Thomas kind of ups the ante because he says, unless I see, which I think is quite reasonable. I'm a bit partial to Thomas here.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
But he also wants to touch. So we get this fullness of sensory experience. And in John's gospel, we've had tasting and, you know, it is a very sensory kind of gospel. But he also wants to touch. He wants the kind of physical evidence in a sense.
Well, Chris Thomas, or John Christopher Thomas is his full name. He goes by Chris, who is a Johanna scholar and a Revelation scholar. He talks about the sensual nature of Revelation, but, you know, also of the Johannine text.
Yep.
And you know, that word means probably something different today in that sense. But, you know, what he means is, as you say, it's sensory. It's about this very lived-in, you know, experience where you do touch Jesus, you do taste Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about this, I can't help but think about, you know, the doctrine of transubstantiation.
Yeah.
As an example of that.
Just
idea.
Say what that is for people who don't know the word.
Oh, of course, yeah. It's the I'm not Catholic, right? So I might get this completely wrong, but my understanding that it is the belief that the Eucharist meal is literally transmuted into the body and blood of Christ as you take it.
Yep.
Which to me, you know, is quite interesting because it places a very high value on the meal itself, but it also, I guess, is a reminder of the physical nature of God.
Yes.
Which is something that I guess it is actually a common thing that we do see in Revelation as well.
Yep.
Right. This appearance, we don't deal with it in today's reading, but this appearance of Jesus, and he's described using earthly terms.
Yeah.
You know, he looks like metal and cloth and, you know.
As a way of trying to make sense of him and make him real and,
That's right, to enflesh him, if you like, or materialize him in today's world.
Yeah. No, I think that it's also worth saying something I think about Thomas, because we tend to only associate him with this story. It's Thomas the twin. poor guy.
Quote unquote doubting Thomas.
Yeah, I know. Don't call him that, please. No. And we'll say why in a minute, because he makes the biggest profession of faith, arguably, in the gospel. But in John 11, Thomas is the one who says to the other disciples, let's go that we might die with him. Like, in a sense, he's not afraid. He's there. Yeah. He's there with the group. And in John 14, Thomas is also, interestingly, the one that ask Jesus questions. So when Jesus talks about I'm going to my father's house, Thomas says, well, we don't know where that is. How can we know the way? So, you know, there is a bit of a pattern of Thomas asking questions and wanting like more info, if you like. But of course his response here, I'm just trying to find the verse, when Jesus does appear, and I think it's notable that Jesus lets him touch.
Yes.
He doesn't berate him and say, oh, you have little belief, you know, you wanted to touch me, well, bad luck, you don't get to. He says, come put your hands here.
Yeah.
Come and see, you know, see my wounds and touch them so that you can come to faith in the way you need to come to faith, that you can believe in the way you need to believe. And then Thomas says, my Lord and my God, in verse 28, which is the only time a human says, my Lord and my God.
And it's interesting because that's Dominus et Deus, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is in Latin.
Yes.
Which is the Roman sort of proclamation of the imperial majesty later. But you're right. It's such a profound revelation of who Jesus is that, no one else really utters. You'd think that Peter would be the one to say that.
Yes, exactly.
But it's not. It's Thomas. It's the one who we kind of consign as the doubter.
Yeah.
Who has to touch Jesus in order to really believe him. But, hey, guess what? It works.
But, yeah, when he does, yeah. So I think there's something interesting in these different little resurrection scenes we get. What did you call them? The Jesus farewell tour?
Yeah, that's right.
At the end of John. Jesus like, hey, I'm risen. Come see me before I go. You know, there's something interesting about, you know, the responses of different people are going to be different. And, I mean, you could play with that as a preacher, I think, in terms of
certainly.
You know, we come to faith differently. Some of us need certain things to happen to truly be able to trust God and make that kind of, you know, big step to a life of faith and a life of discipleship. And Thomas, in a way, is a bit behind the others. Initially, he says what he needs, but then comes to this amazing fullness of faith. And I don't know if it's historically true or not, but the tradition remembers him as going off and doing mission work in like Southeast Asia.
Yeah, he goes to India, doesn't he?
That's the historic tradition. So whether, I don't know how much historic reality that has, but he certainly, you know, responds to the call that's issued.
And it's interesting because, you know, with that, there is this implication when Jesus breathes his spirit on them that there is a missional implication because he says, I send you. But then he has this curious saying, you know, if you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of many, they are retained.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty big responsibility to put on people.
It is. It's massive. And that is a thread, not so much the second half of that, but forgiveness we're going to see in the Acts reading too and, in fact, in Revelation.
That's right.
So that's a bit of a thread that's one of the implications of the resurrection. But, yeah, it's a huge commission, and often this passage is used at Pentecost as well for that reason. It's the giving of the Spirit and then this kind of all the responsibilities that come with that have been with Jesus and now with the Christian community. I don't have much to say about that except we should not take that lightly.
No, that's right. I mean, I was at a group recently where a few people were asking me about, you know, differences in doctrine between denominations and, younger people who are a little bit naive and you know, God bless them for that, and saying things like, oh, do you think they'll get into heaven kind of thing?
Yeah.
And I go, well, I really hope I don't have to be the one to make that decision, nor do I want to be, because, gee, take a step back and think about that.
Yeah.
You know, like, when and if you're the one speaking that over people,
yep.
that's a big responsibility, a heavy weight to bear.
Yeah.
Let's be very very thoughtful and very careful with what we speak over people.
Yeah, and recognize our human limitations, but also recognizing the power, right? I mean, there's in some traditions, whenever there's a prayer of confession, there is also a declaration of, you know, Jesus says your sins are forgiven, and that's because it's not our place in the church to, like, you know, we all need to hear the words of Jesus, not be the ones going, no, your sins are not forgiven.
Yeah.
Of course, that's going to be a bit different depending on your denomination. But
that's right, yeah.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say about this before we move on, you might have something else as well, is how it ends. And in some ways, again, I think here we see this lovely little nod towards the later community for whom this is written, which is, you know, Jesus did many other things. We've got this nice little sort of wrap-up. And these are written that Or even when Jesus' words to Thomas are, blessed of those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. Yeah. So there's a recognition that it was really only a special few who saw the risen Jesus, and most of us encounter faith without that. But we get this nice little nod, and then, of course, how it ends up with, so that believing you might have life, and that's another Johannine theme, that belief is about life. And if our faith in God or our trust in God is not life-giving, we might want to sort of rethink our theology and what we're doing and what our church is telling us or something, Anything else you want to say, or should we move on?
No, I think let's move on then. Okay.
So Acts 5, 27 to 32.
It's a pretty dramatic moment.
It is. So we're still in Jerusalem here, and Peter and some of the other apostles, who we don't get all their names, have been arrested. And then we've had, this is typical of Acts, I feel. I kind of have a funny relationship with Acts because there's all this like over-the-top stuff that happens, right? It's all dramatic and the Spirit's doing all this amazing stuff all the time. So an angel has come and released them all from jail. And what do they do? They go right back to the people who put them in jail and start preaching the gospel.
Yes.
So we might think this is just sheer stupidity, but I think we're supposed to, you know, read this as a kind of, this is witnessing to the resurrection, and it's what a resurrection faith looks like. It's courageous. It's bold. It fronts up to the powers of the day. Yep. Like
this. So it's not headstrong and not foolhardy. I mean, it says in verse 25 before this reading, like, hey, look, they're back.
Yeah, I know, right? And they've gone and checked the prison and the doors are locked and the guards can't be blamed because they're still on duty and they've done their thing, but they're magically
they're in the temple
really
teaching people. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So in some ways, this is a nice antithesis to the gospel, where we've got fear of the Jews and here we have, or the Jewish leaders, I should say, here we've got again the Sanhedrin Council and the high priests, who did wield enormous power over Judea. And Jerusalem. And, you know, these imprisoned people front right back up and say, yep, we're back. And then kind of give a synopsis of the resurrection, really, of the gospel.
Yeah, yeah. And it's this, what I find interesting here is that the threat of violence looms over this entire episode.
Yeah.
But it also seems pretty clear that the followers of Jesus, even though they speak to the violence that has happened, they're not going to be the ones who enact it.
Yes.
Because this reading in particular, actually, it's bookended by this. You know, it says that they brought Peter and the others in, but without violence, because they were afraid of being stoned by the people. And then at the end of that, the next verse says, when they heard this, they were enraged and wanted to kill them.
Yes.
And the very middle of that is, well, you killed Jesus by hanging him on a tree.
Yeah, I know. So we've got all this threat of violence from different groups. And even I was really struck this time, where is it, verse 28, that when the high priest questions them, and, you know, and the instruction is, we told you basically, stop teaching this in Jerusalem. You are determined to bring this man's blood on us. So you can get a sense of their fear there of the crowd, in that verse you pointed out just before. The other thing that really struck me, is that when Peter then preaches about the resurrection, he doesn't preach vengeance and damnation on them for imprisoning God's people, or even for killing Jesus. I mean, that verse stands, and we need to be careful about how we issue that, and that it is addressed to the Jewish leadership, not to Jews everywhere. But he goes on to then preach forgiveness of sins. This is the result of the resurrection. So ultimately, mercy is shown even to those who have imprisoned and incarcerated the apostles.
Yeah. There's something very interesting in this, that in verse 29, Peter says we must obey God rather than any human authority, which is potentially a very dangerous thing to say.
It is.
Especially in, you know, in light of the last couple of years where we've seen all kinds of claims being made.
Yeah.
But I think that is balanced by verse 32. Which says, we are witnesses to these things, and so is the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to those who obey him.
Yeah,
it's almost like there is the check and the balance straight away, where yes, you know, we obey God rather than human authority, but at the same time, our scope is limited to witness and to the move or activity of the spirit.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, we get to say and do whatever we want, you know, forget authority and all that.
Yeah, it's not about, and it's not about our freedom to do whatever we want with zero cost.
Or consequence.
Yeah, and I found, I've been reading Willie Jennings' commentary on Acts for the first time this year, and he's a scholar at Yale Divinity School, and it primarily works as a theologian. And he comments here about how, you know, incarceration has been used in this scene as a tool of political oppression and horror. Mm-hmm. And even though the apostles are freed by an angel of the Lord, they are free, but they are not safe.
Mm.
And so he says this, you know, passage really raises a question for us about how do we respond to the spirit at work in the world, knowing that to do so is freedom, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee safety.
Yeah, wow, that's remarkably challenging, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's another thing you can play with and maybe, you know, picks up some of the same things in the gospel reading, I think, with fear and safety and what a Christian faith looks like. We might want to hide behind locked doors, but actually we're propelled, like Peter, into the very places that could harm us.
Which is also what Revelation says, so there you go.
There you go, nice segue. We probably do need to move on.
If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, please visit bythewell.com.au.
Okay, and here we are in Revelation chapter 1, verses 4 to 8. Now, you know, if you looked at the episode hosts, you may have realized that you've got two Revelation scholars here. So we put it at the end so that we wouldn't spend the whole podcast talking about it.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, this is sort of the opening, if you like, you know, the initial address of John to the seven churches. At first glance, it looks like your standard epistolary greeting, but there's actually a great deal of profundity within it. Did you want to say anything about that as a greeting?
Well, not so much the greeting. I mean, I do think we need to pack it. It's four verses, but the theology is...
Yeah.
Thick, right? So we'll just for people who don't know, this John is John of Patmos, probably not the same John of the Gospel. Probably we're looking at the late first century here. So these seven churches in Asia are they're named later in the book, so Ephesus and Smyrna and places around what is modern Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing I'd say about seven is this number functions as a kind of universal. So there's a sense that John is also writing to the universal church.
Mm.
And I think he certainly thinks of himself in that way and as a prophet doing that work.
Yeah. And you know, almost immediately we see another seven, like the seven spirits. And all the way throughout, we do see cycles of seven throughout the text.
Yeah. Representing perfection. So we have the standard greeting of grace and peace.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately a kind of Trinitarian title for God, but in terms of time, who is, who was, and who is coming. Mm. Which I like that who is first, because one of the things this author will do is say, you know, God is here, God is in your midst, God is working, God is seeing what's going on in the world, but is also coming. And, of course, we get that here with this look every eye will see him. You know, there is a sense that we're in this... Something has happened that's reshaped the cosmos, but also more is yet to happen kind of space.
It's very now, not yet, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to read this as a – I think the observation I made when I read this was that it is a microcosm of the whole book.
Yeah.
You know, it's if you want to explain someone, you know, the all 22 chapters of Revelation in four verses, read this and you're pretty well sorted.
Yes. So Jesus Christ, let's perhaps unpack some of these terms I'll throw some to you. The faithful witness, I love this. This witness word is martyr. So again, we've got a witnessing thing. But martyr, you know, becomes martyr.
Yep.
So he's the faithful witness precisely because he went to the point of the cross. So the cross is never really explicitly, or only once is the cross or crucifixion mentioned explicitly in Revelation, but it's understood.
Yeah, it sort of hangs over the whole text, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, and obviously the theme of witness is picked up over and over again all the way throughout the text. Then you have Firstborn of the Dead, which presumably is about resurrection and, yeah. and this idea that, well, I mean, really Lazarus should be
should be the firstborn
of the yeah. dead, but that's okay. We'll skim right by that. But and then Ruler of the Kings of the Earth. That's a that's a big statement.
Yeah. So we've gone in one verse. We've gone, you know, the one who died, the one who's raised, and the one who's ascended almost and now rules. Mm. So a really shorthand way, but of capturing a huge amount of theology. And I do think some of this firstborn of the dead, I mean, that's very Pauline, right, where he talks about death through the first Adam and life through the second. So, you know, there's some of that. And it smacks too of promise, right?
Yeah.
He's the firstborn. There will be more, and we're supposed to see ourselves in that.
Mm. And there's also an implicit challenge all the way through this of the question of authority or royalty, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, ruler of the kings of the earth. Well, that's the imperator.
Yeah. Right?
You know, because the Romans have the client kings and really the imperator rules over all of them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, later glory and dominion and made us to be a kingdom and things like that.
Yes.
There's very sort of a challenge to earthly authority implicit in the very person of Jesus.
Yes, and religion and politics are so deeply entwined here that you cannot separate them.
Yeah, that's right.
Even if we jump to the end, you know, where this ends with that word almighty, which of course we sing in hymns and things, you know, and perhaps don't think much of it, but this pantocrator word only appears here in Revelation. But I can't help but think, again, it's doing a deliberate political thing. We know there's an inscription in Ephesus, in the Sebastoi temple that calls Emperor Domitian, which is around the same time period, 80s and 90s, autocrator, or autocrat.
Mm.
And one of the things we know this author does is he goes, well, your emperor's called this, but I'm going to up the ante. So if the emperor is autocrat, well, God is pantocrat, you know, almighty, not just mighty. We've got to hear, and these are not necessarily, well, depending on your denomination again, we don't always love this kind of mighty, powerful, ruling language for God.
Yeah, it can be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mm. In some ways, there's lots of ways you could use this reading this week. One of them is to explore the language we use for God in our hymns, in our prayers. Yeah. There's lots of wonderful hymns that use Revelation images. But just to unpack, like, what are our go-to titles? How do we address God? And what's the kind of implications? You know, what are the... Yeah.
What are the, the assumptions that we make about who God is? And even, you know, when I read Revelation, the question I always get is, you know, where is God in relation to the other authorities or powers in my life?
Yeah.
And in all our lives? And you know, is he really the ruler of the kings of the earth? Is he really, you know, the pantocrator?
Yeah.
Is he really the almighty, the alpha and the omega, or does he get relegated to second, third best?
Yes. And I do, again, that alpha and omega is, you know, is God really the beginning and the end of our being?
Mm.
Or do we actually live in a way that implies God's somewhere sitting around letter G or whatever and gets ignored most days? Yeah. So there's lots you could do with this. Is there anything else you want to comment on?
I mean, I love the proclamation in verse 7. You know, he is coming with the clouds. Every eye will see him, even those who pierced him.
Yeah.
And on his account, all the tribes of earth will wail. Now, that one obviously is a bit more of a sorrowful probably declaration. But, you know, it is this idea that, you know, the eternal blessed hope that we have, which is the purpose of Easter, right? You know, that along with crucifixion also comes resurrection.
Yeah.
And the hope in the future that no matter how bad things get, that, you know, that the kingdom of God will prevail.
Yeah, precisely. Now, if you are going to take the challenge of preaching on Revelation over the next few weeks, there's two resources to tell you about. One is Frank Maloney, who's a scholar based here in Melbourne, has written a fabulous, more accessible kind of Revelation book called Reading Revelation at Easter Time. Mm-hmm. And the other is Ewan's other podcast.
Tell us
what that's called.
It's called Unveiling Apocalypse, and it's a limited run at the moment. I think I've only got 5 episodes, but essentially what I've done is interviewed a range of Revelation scholars from different traditions and different backgrounds. It is reasonably high level.
Yep.
You know, everyone's sort of a doctoral person in Revelation. But, yeah, you know, it's we just talk through different things, different ideas, where what we think the text is about and things like that. And it's there for people to be able to hear that high-level conversation, which most people wouldn't have access to.
Yeah, and to perhaps fill in some gaps. So we'll put a link to that on the Facebook page as well as in the notes. Mm. Thanks, Ewan.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.